Namaste and in La Ketch, and welcome to this episode of One World and New World. And I'm Zen Benefiel, your host. My guest this week is Roger Martin. Now, I met Roger several years ago as a participant on the Friendship Bench, which a good friend of ours, Dennis Bitaco, hosts every week, Thursday mornings. If you haven't explored it, I invite you to do so. It's a great gathering of people from around the world to talk about becoming better people. Now,
and if you're in the UK, it's 4:30 in the afternoon on a Thursday.
There we go. All right. So inquiring into helpful questions that change lives is one of the things that Roger loves to do. He helps leaders and project professionals be at their best, irrespective of circumstances. He's a co-founder of The Mindset Difference. They help leaders and teams to achieve their best. And also, he is a podcast host of A Better Way. And the organization itself is a cross-sectoral network of leaders committed to improving services, building community, and creating a fairer society. Now, there are some reflections for Roger that I noticed he's had, and this is going to be exciting. And as an author on Substack and BizCatalyst 360 as well, he's refreshingly different, really powerful, highly relevant, life-changing, and extremely enjoyable. And I found him to be extremely enjoyable. Roger, thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me and inviting me, Zen. It's a joy to be here.
Been a long time coming too. So in this exploration of self, my guests, I explore how they discovered their inner voice, wisdom, guide. You know, we have different experiences at different times in our life. Some of us do anyway, not everybody does. And we're seeking, I'm seeking to help those who may have felt they're a bit crazy because they've had these kinds of experiences and had no one to talk to about them. So now there's a chance for reflection and being able to understand that, oh, I'm not the only one. And I hope that's a gift to our audience. So Roger, how did you first begin to understand that there was more to life than just the physical structures and the thinking about them?
Well, I guess it happened around 2014, so 10 years ago. I had a difficult, I had quite a successful career, but a very difficult personal life, and had suffered bouts of depression. And whilst I'd been to various psychotherapies and counseling sessions and taken various antidepressants, it had partially worked, but it hadn't fully worked. So I kept getting bouts of depression.
Mm-hmm.
And then quite by chance, my partner, Selena, saw an advert for a meetup locally run by a local chap called Paul, who had been studying the work of Sydney Banks and the three principles, which aimed to explain why we experience life as we do. His inquiry was, what are the principles that underpin all human experience? And I guess being the sort of chap I am, that spoke to me. It kind of, you know, like, oh wow, if I can get my head around that.
Oh yeah, the curiosity would be piqued, right? It's like, what's this about? Are there principles, and what might they be?
Exactly. And so we went along to those meetings, and they were weekly. And my, as you say, my curiosity got piqued even more, and I devoured several books and went on various courses and just more deeply inquired into what is the nature of experience. But, you know, whether it be bloody awful, you know, you'd be at the pits of despair, which I've been, or whether it be blissful and joyous, what is underpinning all of that?
Right. And I can answer that question, if I may, as a teen, when I went through my experiences and awakening, I was told at that point, you know, beware, my life's going to be full of trials and tribulations. Just have faith and trust that, you know, everything will be there at its appointed time. And it turned out to be true. It didn't make the journey any less tumultuous.
Yeah.
It just made it easier to deal with, I think.
Well, I think my reflection on it is that over the last 10 years is the nature of transformation means you step into an unknown.
Yeah.
And I think that I was certainly very reticent about that to begin with.
I think we all are, right?
Yeah, well,
it's like, no, it, change what? I'm happy
yeah.
where I'm at, or well, at least I think I'm happy where I'm at. Life
It
doesn't,
was.
you know, necessarily reflect that, though.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was the last summer I had the insight around, well, this is the inspiration for the Substack, Helpful Questions Change Lives, because my own experience had been that having that question, why do I experience life as I do, front of mind with no answers, no real answers to it, but it acted as a guide rail. It acted as a sort of focal point with which to take a fairly giant step into an unknown field. And it felt comfortable having that question alongside me as I discovered more about the nature of my own experience. And so my reflection last summer, when we had a month off and I got pretty quiet in my head, was, well, let's try and help others. Not so much Zen in your that you describe what you're doing, which is helping those that have had awakening experiences, but I sort of see myself earlier on in the process, downstream a bit, as it were, with people who are thinking about, can my life transform? Can it be different? What would that entail? And does the why do I experience life as I do question interest me too? And so I'm sort of offering some of my own journey there to help those who are wondering about starting on a similar one themselves.
Do you think that in the process of the pandemic, you know, when it first began, we went on lockdown here, and I had this sense of, okay, there's a new beginning happening, there's a door opening. And I told my wife, St. Petersburg, Russia, initially, and grew up in the USSR before she came here. I said to her, you know, I really hope that this obsession on self-hygiene and sequestration will get people to turn inward and examine themselves and start asking those questions. And it seems, survey says anyway, and from our own experience of accessing and finding the bench, right?
Yeah,
Dennis
absolutely.
Started it during the pandemic. There were multiple groups, virtual groups, that began to form in the next few months after that of people looking for each other.
That was my experience too. The bench being one, there are several others that I attend to. And it, yes, I agree. It was people reassessing, looking at what they really value in life. And as you say, looking within to answer some of those questions rather than to somebody else to answer it for them. And, yeah, I think that's been, I think that's set in motion the change we're still seeing unfold. That's how I see it. I think we're still.
Absolutely. And it will unfold for some time because we're just entering in. We're like babes in the woods with this.
Yeah.
Right? Some of us have had prep work. You know, mine, I had 50 years of prep work to be ready for this. And it's rather prophetic. And I say that because there's references all over the place, from calendars to spiritual texts to cultural legends and all of, you know, those kinds of things, that this is a time of transition between the Piscean and the Aquarian age, for one. That's one reference. Piscean age being mostly patriarchal, the Aquarian age being a blend of masculine and feminine energies now. And so there's a rise in understanding in that. And then there's also references that there is a wave of change where there's this new understanding, Mayan calendar, right? We're going into a new time where this understanding of our greater aspects is actually being paid attention to. Been there for a long time. The Vedas actually 15,000 years ago held the information of this unit of consciousness, and that we're all divine threads of it, incarnate, and according to that philosophy, capable of becoming God conscious. Now, to a lot of folks, that's blasphemous. Why do you think that is?
I'm just working off the top of my head here, but it's probably inscribed in scriptures somewhere that isn't there something about we're made in the image of God, so that therein lies a
separation.
It's
them, not singular, is what the original reference was.
Sorry, I don't understand. Say that again.
It was then. So there's a plural. In the original Genesis, it was referred to, we were made in their image.
Okay.
So that was kind of interesting.
Not his image or her image or its image.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So this gives us that okay, there's more. There's, you know, and how do we at least open ourselves to the understanding or the possibility of it, to where we're curious enough to let go of the shore and hop into that relationship and navigate the ocean of emotion to find safe harbor in a new understanding of that connectivity.
Yeah, which is non-dualistic in nature when you're at higher levels of consciousness, and not dualistic in nature when you're at lower levels of consciousness and you're only seeing black or white, right or wrong, either or. That's how I understand it.
Once who was it that said it's nothing is good or bad, it's our thinking that makes it so?
Yeah.
That's an interesting pearl of wisdom, right?
I often use the word well-being to describe an equilibrium of the mind where you're neither wrapped up in the past or the future, but you're totally open and curious in the present to what might be next. And there is a freedom from dualism in that state of consciousness, which helps me and others that I speak to, you know, see situations from multiple different angles and make new sense of things in a way you simply can't do if you're wedded to being right and somebody else having to be wrong, or you're wedded to good because something else is bad. You know, you don't you only tend towards one end of the polarity, and you don't integrate both ends.
Well, speaking of the polarities, do you find that when you hold a strong sentiment towards something as being bad, or you're judging another person, have you then later found yourself in a similar situation that kind of flips the table?
Yeah, I mean,
you're in
I,
that.
I'll give you an example. So I would get, as we all do, get emotionally hijacked by something that we find abhorrent, and have a visceral reaction to that. But the I've come to the point where this has a truism for me, where we're only ever experiencing our thinking, and that that leads me to a place where even when somebody's doing something abhorrent or has done something abhorrent, you get to a point where you think, well, if I were living in the thinking they were living in at the time, that could be me too. And it's that realization, it's the there but for the grace of God go I idea,
right,
that makes me grateful for the fact I'm not in that position, grateful that I'm not as unhelpful thinking doesn't
You're
grip
bound
me.
by the deviance.
You're bound by the deviance, good way of putting it. But that takes that awakening, it takes that curiosity, it takes that wonder in order to not be hijacked by that. And that's the work, I think. That's the work that if a terrorist did, or a murderer did, or so many people did, they could see perhaps that the emotional hijack they're in at the point of committing a crime needn't be the only one available to them. And if that realization were to be present for them, there's a high probability that they are unlikely to commit the crime that so many of us find abhorrent.
Sure. Well, do you find that I'll just put it simply, that we really seek to love and be loved, and that the fear of not having that often provokes these aberrant behaviors?
Yeah. Ultimately, you're right. I remember I was talking to Andy Scarantino about this, and she was saying, she wrote a piece on LinkedIn, which is connected to the war that's going on in the world right now. And she ended the piece saying, we know what the answer is. It is to look within and find love. And that stuck with me, moved me profoundly, actually, those words. And yeah, we can find ways through when it's present in a way we can't when it's absent.
Sure. And do you find that, it's really a challenge to, and this goes back to the question as to why we can't accept that we are capable of God consciousness, which is that unification of love, both inner and outer, right?
Yeah.
Half inside and half outside. And these conversations that I'm having now is about the inner, which most of us are bereft of distilling anything from, because we get hijacked and we can't find stillness. So how do you think, and I may have lost the question I had originally, but how do you think that we are able to understand quieting the mind a bit more and to be able to do so? Because my understanding, it seems, maybe you can reflect on this as well, that it's not about stopping the mind, it's about, and the thoughts, it's just about becoming aware of them as an observer.
Yes, that's how I would put it too. The observer observing the observed. It's the, I'm not a, I was counseled in doing positive thinking at one time. And I found that somewhat difficult to do in some circumstances, because if my inner experience was in turmoil and I was, feeling quite despairing, it felt like a form of self-denial to just overlay on top of that.
Inauthentic.
Yeah, it felt inauthentic. And it didn't really deal with the, the hijack I was in, the emotional state I was in. And it's your point around observing that state arising, because you can't control it. You can't stop it arising. I often say to people, you can't choose goosebumps. You can't choose a knot in the stomach, You
right.
can't choose sweaty palms. It just arises. And the thoughts and feelings that come with it. So as you suggest, I find the quietening of the mind comes from being with that, not having to fight it, not having to work against it, think positively through it, any of that stuff, but just being with it and noticing it arise, noticing its transience, because it is a transient state of mind that moves through us. And the more we can detach, as it were, I was thinking, get on a ceiling or on a tree and look down on ourselves, observe ourselves experiencing these sensations, thoughts, and feeling from a figurative distance.
And being curious about them too.
And being curious about it without overthinking it. I think that that's
Or
the.
thinking, period. You know, this is one of the things that occurred to me years ago, and I think quantum physics is backing it up now. We can't think our way through a system built on vibration. We have to feel our way through it.
Exactly.
Now, in doing that, quieting the mind, being able to observe the thoughts, and eventually, did you find that as you began to observe them, that eventually they began to dissipate and you could choose thoughts that were more present?
Yeah, I have a phrase that says that often springs to mind when life gets a little tumultuous. So I'll notice it. So I'll notice the knot in the stomach or the sweaty palms, and I see that as a signal that I'm not thinking clearly about something. So I see it as a kind of warning sign, and I will get into so I won't necessarily take it so seriously. I'm not saying every time. Sometimes
Sure.
I forget this stuff, right?
Well, yeah, we get caught up in the moment and it's like, oh,
yeah,
right, we're
yeah,
human.
yeah. And but when I do remember, it's, oh, this is arising, so let's be with this, let's see what will emerge as I just be with it. And it's like this phrase is, oh, well, if not this, then what? And I just find that helps me be with whatever's occurring, and reminds me of its transience. And it also acts as a reminder to me, who'd been a depression sufferer, that to dwell on it and to ruminate on it, and to make it loom large in one's inner life, is what caused the depression. Now, that's what, because for me, depression was about descending down a ruminating hole to the point where all other perspective was lost, and completely inaccessible. And the, you know, that. That voice in my head that was very self-critical and very judgmental of me. I often now refer to it as a flatmate that would follow me around every room and never get lost when I told it to.
You know, it reminds me of the two of you, angel and a devil on your shoulders, right? And they're both talking to you. It was interesting, after I had my experience at 18, I really was profoundly affected by it and wanted to criticize it and really unpack it, look at all the different things, including the notion that, oh my God, this could have been Satan appearing to me, right? Which is what the Christian philosophy is of these beings that come from the light and, you know, they're not who they say they are and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So I was prompted to go to the university library and look up the word Satan. So I walk into the library, they've got these two, you know, massive volumes, A through M and or A through L and M through Z or something like that. But the things are like 3 or 4 inches thick. What I found was in the very first reference to the word, it referenced the Greek Thetan, Thetan,
which
meaning
means what?
Thinker.
Right.
So we're all thinkers.
Yeah.
It's how we choose to think that makes the difference. And I particularly enjoyed the twist that the crafters of the scriptures put in there to create a fictitious enemy to battle and to be intercessors of. Instead of saying, hey, look, you have the power within you, just as many, you know, spiritual guides, including Christ, had said, we've all got a direct connect. Use it.
Yeah.
You got to get quiet in order for that to emerge. And back to the feeling side of things, right? When you exhausted that thinking, in your rabbit hole and you reached the bottom, was there a sense or a feeling that then emerged in new thoughts?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm trying to get at how to
Once you reach the
articulate it.
bottom, once you reach the bottom, you either never want to come out and become suicidal, or you realize you're at the bottom and you know there's only one way from there, which is up. And that manifests as a feeling. You don't think your way out of that. It just manifests as a, oh, I can't carry on with this this thinking any longer. So I'm going to get out and I'm going to go for a walk, and I'm not going to stay under my duvet for a fifth day in a row. And, you know, I'm going to engage with people, and you know, it emerges, but you don't think your way out of it. It just comes
And it's
up.
a choice to emerge, you know, it's that recognition that, okay, that there's got to be something more, the curiosity, the willingness to let go and be open to, and then that emergence of that sense that, as I said before, validates quantum physics, right? The resonance, the harmonic of your frequency, if you will, shifts from one that is totally condensing into nothingness to emerging into a sense of isness, of allness, and being connected to it. And then, did you notice that there were moments of serendipity and synchronicity that helped guide you along the way? And how did that affect things?
You mean when I was coming out of depression? Yeah, there were moments.
Or even going into that you didn't recognize until you got out and looked back.
Well, on the way out, before I'd had my moment of awakening and you know, started looking at the why do I experience life as a do question in more depth. On the way out of a depression, you could become quite self-incriminating. So, you know, why on earth did you think all those days about this? Why have you spent the last 24 hours ruminating on this when, you know, you're worried about
5,000 thoughts that we have, right? Most of them are self-deprecating at that point.
Yeah, absolutely. I had a PhD in self-criticism, I tell you. So that was, and to take the point you raised, which occurred to me when you were talking, was that to just be with all of that and as you say, let it go, is where the fear was. Because I would say to myself, well, if I let all this go, who the hell am I? If I don't think in these patterns anymore, given the upbringing I had, given where I grew up, given everything that's happened to me, if I do, quote you, let that go, then who the hell am I? What then? And that can appear as a terribly frightening question.
Absolutely.
Or an immensely curious one, because it takes you into the, well, what could it be if not this?
It could be both.
It could,
right?
Be
because then that curiosity is the fright of what am I going to find?
Yeah.
Right?
But I think to your point around people being more at ease with their inner life and having experiences like you and I have had, the journey to that does involve a letting go and recognizing that that can be fearful, as it was for me, actually turned out to be unjustified. You know, the letting go and stepping into a much more curious frame of mind around, you know, why this emotion is occurring, or why am I thinking about something in this way, or why is this back pain or pain in the neck or headache or whatever it is, what's the root of all of that, becomes a sort of playful, curious, wonderment. You know, it becomes an enjoy, becomes life becomes more joyful because of that. And I now look back and realize that the fear of letting go wasn't justified, however real it was at the time. It seemed
Right.
very real at the time.
And that's a great point to make, is that our fears are unjustified most of the time. You know, like 99% of them never happen. And we prove to ourselves over time that they don't, because our experience demonstrates it. Now, there's another fear, though, that I had a conversation with Jesus one time, and I was really, overwhelmed by it to begin with, that it would even happen in the first place. So I was in a state of really deep humility and a sense of unworthiness to begin with. But then he says to me that my fears were the same as his were. And what I understood that to mean, as I've mentioned with you before, and I'll share here, is that in that awakening I had as a teenager, I was told that I am here to help facilitate a new world order of harmony among people and planet. So my greatest fear is of not being able to accomplish that, to fulfill my mission. And so from the same reference, I think it is, that's probably how Jesus felt, a tremendous fear of, even though, we don't know the full story, we only have remnants of it. However, for a person to have gone through that and still maintained integrity with it is just amazing. Ineffable when it comes to that. That's a feeling, right? That you just, it's that awe of how can somebody actually do that? And I find, like, meeting you and discovering the bench, and it's helped to edify this notion that yes, there is a progression, and all of the trials and tribulations that I've had have led to this wonderful network and development of relationships and conversations that actually matter and are worthy to share.
That's exactly how my life is unfolding too. I'm having very different conversations with people than I could ever have dreamt of 15 years ago. I could never have had this conversation with you 15 years ago.
I'm hip. That was the, for me,
I wouldn't have understood a word you were saying half the
many still don't, trust me. And I'm used to that. For years, I went from being institutionalized because of what I was saying to actually, 35 years later, I had the opportunity to speak to the International Association for Near-Death Studies.
All right.
And that was in 2010 at their annual conference. So, huge shift in foundation at that point, of actually having the listening instead of closed ears. And then a few years later, I had started a TV show back in the 90s talking about having these kinds of conversations. Couldn't go to the depth that we do today because I was 30 years younger, right? And I hoped someday to have to be worthy of an interview with either Jeffrey Mishlove or Bill Moyers, who were the two icons that I wanted to emulate in my own interviewing style.
Right.
And so that was 1990. 2018 comes around, and I get a voicemail from Jeffrey regarding something completely different. I manage a website called Ufology Press, and it's kind of about UFOs and paranormal kind of stuff. And he reaches out to me and says, "Hey, I just did this voicemail," which was the only method that I had on there. SnakePipe actually is the plugin for those listening, if you ever want to use that. So I hear his voice, I recognize it before he even introduces, says his name, and my heart just starts pitter-pattering. And he says, "Hey, I just did an interview with Jason Trigiani about the Greys, and I think your audience would be interested in it. would you take a look and see if you could help promote it? And so I did, wrote a blog post, posted it, linked to the interview, and then I sent him a PDF copy of my big book, which is called Stubbing My Toe on Purpose, A Seminal View of Consciousness, Cosmology, and the Congruence of Science and Spirituality. 3 days later, I get an email back, hey, would you like to come talk about it? So that was in June. August, my wife and I drove up to Albuquerque, and we had three conversations, not just one. So this was like a huge validation for me. 28 years in the making.
Yeah.
So, and I say that not just to say, hey, look at me. I'm saying that to illustrate patience, perseverance, and persistence in what you're doing.
Yeah.
Will eventually bring your passion and purpose to bear.
Yeah.
Now, how have you noticed in your upcoming, you mentioned that, you know, you've got the podcast, you've got the group that you're working with. How did you see that emerging, and where might we be going collectively as a network, as well as a global civilization? Because there are layers and clusters and you know, ripples, if you will, of activity throughout them.
Well, I guess I'll come to the ripples, but let me start with the more personal. I think that one of the changes I've noticed is that in myself is that when my head isn't as busy as it used to be, my capacity to listen to somebody is vastly increased. And that's important because if you want to have a deeper conversation about these kinds of issues and, you know, why we are experiencing life as we do, it's my euphemism for that, that you need it. It's important to start with relevant language, I think, about it, the language that the person you're speaking to is using, rather than
absolutely. The language. I know your audience.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I do a lot of work with project teams in the construction sector, you know, which is a sector that's renowned for delivering late and overspent time and time again.
So I love that. And I don't think you knew this, and pardon me for, you know, the tangentialism. We're all tangentialists, right? So partnering. But I did that for 20 years, building road and bridge construction. I was the guy that stood in the middle of the room and helped build the stakeholder team to address their teamwork, as well as look at future issues based on the contracts and the 2 to 5 year usually time span of the contract or the project schedule, and have issue resolution plans in place so that when those things happen, there was no work stoppage. Because as you know, that's 10 to hundreds of thousands of dollars an hour.
That's I didn't know we had that in common, but we do.
Yeah.
So yeah, so we work with leaders of project, the project directors, who leaders and project directors and their teams find a way of working together that isn't all task, 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 with no attention to the question of how they work together and how they feel about how they work together. Because
exactly. Because
if you get to a point where people are enjoying each other's company, and the inevitable, with so many moving parts on a project, you're always going to get problems crop up. But if they crop up as, you know, interesting puzzles to solve because we're together on this, rather than they show up as, you know, another pain in the butt because so and so hasn't done what they bloody well should have done.
Sure. Then, you know, I use a couple of terms I think you'll love and maybe able to incorporate. Jobarchy is being one of them. The job's the boss, everybody wins. And there's no ego without we go.
Right. I hadn't heard that, but yeah.
I use that. I get weird looks when I say that, but I'm weird anyway. And, you know, those are triggers, right?
Yeah.
When you can open a mind simply by something that you say that gets them to go, huh? The door opens.
The similar one I've heard is there's no I in team.
Yes. Yeah, that's a traditional use.
So the work I do is helping people understand that, we all go up and down emotionally. We can get stuck there if we're working under pressured conditions, which like a project can induce.
Right, because you want to control things.
Absolutely. And unless we understand that movement of from good mood to bad mood to high to low, and how the thinking that we live in causes that helps cause those shifts.
It's transient and temporary.
Exactly. And if we've got an appreciation of that, then the way we show up to the challenges we face, the challenges don't change, but the way we show up to them changes.
Then that's the key point.
And that's the work I do. And
So, how does this inner development affect that? What do you notice as some core shifts in how your understanding of self affects the understanding of others?
well, we do a session on our workshop about what we call separate realities, which is, once you see that you're creating your own reality through the sensations and thoughts and feelings you're paying attention to in consciousness about what's going on out there, rather than fall into the trap we all can fall into, which is we believe what's going out there is causing what's going on in here, rather than the internal.
Paradigm shift to the
Yeah.
reverse.
Once that beds in and people, what we say, realize that for themselves. So we run a sort of retreat-like workshop over 4 days, where over the first 2 days we say to people, we're going to slow down, and it may feel very odd for you. It might feel very strange for you, but there's a method to our madness, which is we can't see afresh. We can't see something new. We're not open to insight when our brains are running at 50,000 miles an hour. So we slow it down, deliberately slow it down. And then people start to see, like I saw, that I'd been caught up in stuff with my inner voice constantly nagging at me for years and years and years. And when you do observe that, you see that, then one of the changes that occurs in people is that they realize that not only are they creating their own reality, but so is everybody else in the team doing the same. So you then you their shift normally occurs then from, rather than trying to cajole or persuade or win a case to get everyone to think the way you think, you move to a place of, let's understand the realities we are all in on issue X first, before we let a new solution emerge, so that we don't have to, argue against one another for
Right.
my
We
solution.
acknowledge and then elevate.
You acknowledge, and it'll be a nice way of summarizing it. And doing that from the understanding that we can all elevate, when we're in an elevated position, and we might need to show compassion and empathy for somebody who's not in a good place, who are in a fearful, worried place, and give them space to share what they're worried about, share what they're fearing, because often that's what will block the progress. So if you can solve for that,
Well, it's the
then
communication
you make
that keeps
progress at a much, much faster rate.
absolutely. And that brings to mind something that Wilbert Smith said. Wilbert ran the I'm going to drop off the planet again, go back to the moon, and so to speak. So Wilbert Smith ran Canada's UFO investigation program, much like the US's Project Blue Book in the 1950s. And he had conversations with people from elsewhere, is what he called them. One of the things they said is that their perception of time is a measurement in the change of entropy. So, plugging that back into what you were just saying, time to completion, schedules can be truncated when things are in harmony because everything's flowing. It's when it's not that schedules are pushed out. So by reaching this, there's a tremendous, and what you're saying works not only for project teams, it works for relationships, it works for pretty much everything in life, that you slow down, take things in, and then, like, I think it's Redfield's book, The Celestine Prophecy, the third insight is allow that voice to come from within you, and don't think things right or want to prescribe or project. Just wait until you're prompted from deep within you to speak. Now that's a tough one.
It is. But your question was around what change do I see people making? And these are the changes I see people making. So, planning something through and really, getting where everyone's coming from and letting, as you say, something emerge, something, a way forward and emerge. It speaks to what's in the minds of that group at that time in that place. That sort of planning work is often considered a talking shop or a nonsense or a waste of time, or we just get let's get building, let's get the shovels in the ground, let's get started, right?
Right. Same thing with training development, corporate life. That's one of the last things that's addressed. One of the first things to go when budgets are cut.
So what we see is teams taking a much more rounded approach to the challenges that they face, that's much more cognizant of the separate realities everyone is living from. And of course, that has two effects, I think, which, to take your point about rippling out on a wider scale, I think it means that one, there's a useful, what would you call it? Skepticism, discernment about authority, about relying on one authority for a way forward, whether that's a senior project director or a prime minister or a head of state or whatever it might be. So there's a discernment about that. Have those in authority our best interests at heart, or can they see what's needed in these circumstances as clearly as we ourselves can?
Are they an alpha or are they a servant leader? Right. This is one of the new terms that's come up in the last few years is servant leadership. Been there for a long time for some, right? Because there are those who do understand the emotional intelligence it takes to get people, places, and things to move into better space, right? It's a facilitation process. Do you find that it is a challenge to get folks to really open up and discuss those core things, or how deep can you go with those, or what do you find are the deeper conversations that arise that are unexpected?
Well, one of the conversations, what is the role of a leader in tomorrow, in today's world? Because if you look at the models we have of leadership, going back to the tribes, going back to divinely given leadership of leadership of churches and religions and so on, and you come into the modern, the captains of industry during the Industrial Revolution. I wrote about this in a recent post on my Substack. What you see, and then through to servant leader and agile leadership is one that people are talking about at the moment, humble leadership, etc. What I see as a trend in the way we've collectively thought about leadership is that power is moving from it being focused around, centralized around one individual or a small cabal of individuals, to it being distributed more widely to people on the front line who are interacting with customers or,
So the hierarchy is shifting from the alpha male at the top of the pyramid right, in competition with other silos,
Yeah.
basically, and it's becoming more of a collaborative, almost chaotic system, kind of like D Hawk when he started Visa, where there was no leadership. There was just a bunch of people with skills and things to do, and they all chose how to do them collectively to meet the mission and vision.
That's the transition we're in, I think, because because the pace of technological change is such a pace that no one individual can know that the nuances in shifts in clients' perceptions or employees' feelings or and
Seems
all
like
of
a
that.
perfect place to recognize, okay, we've got to slow down because there's so much here. Every one of us picks up a piece of it. So we need to share those pieces so that we can create a whole.
Exactly right. And what that means for the way leaders think about their role is a shift from I'm not the one who has to do all the sense making, choice making, and action taking, but I'm the one that needs to create the conditions in which many others throughout my organizations can do good sense making, choice making, and action taking. And that becomes that's a shift I see people making, is that I'm a facilitator. You know, as a leader, I'm facilitating bringing out the potential and the talent of others to make good sense of what's going on, to make good choices around what to do, and then to make it happen, to actually get the action done. And you want that widespread, and you know those three things have tightly coupled, so that that's happening on a regular basis.
Right.
So that's
it creates award-winning projects eventually. I mean, that's the result. I know for me, we've got a Marvin M. Black Award here in the States, and several of my projects achieved that because of the way that we organized the planning and strategy of how they were going to work
yeah
as a team.
And there's been a very good book written recently by a Danish professor called Professor Bent Fleevberg, I think is how you pronounce it, but he's a professor at Oxford University, and he's wrote a book called How to Get Big Things Built. I think that was the title of it. I might have got the title wrong, but it's an excellent book that points out the difference between projects that have gone exceedingly well in terms of being delivered on time and within budget, compared to the something like 8, 9.5 out of 10 that are always late. And always over budget. And it is in this, you know, no hierarchy, people feeling a sense of belonging, people's views counting in, and planning being seen as a really vital, critical part, so that when you come to delivery, so much of it has already been thought through in absolute detail, that delivery isn't flying by your seat of your pants. You know, it's a real enactment of a clear, coordinated set of activities. So that's the world I live in, and I see those trends in terms of leaders recasting their role, inviting more of us to step up to the leadership plate, to get things done collectively in a way we were dependent on others to decide for us before, enabled by blockchain technology, Web 3.0, you know, a currency native to the internet that isn't held up by banks who charge a lot of money to transfer it across the world.
Another conversation. You mentioned that. It triggered a thought of me. I had a conversation with a friend of mine we'd met at a World Futures Society breakfast, and he worked for IBM for a time and was in charge of a bunch of programmers. And he was very interesting, you know, in that he'd grown up in the telecom industry, was brilliant. And he said, you know, where things are going is into a microeconomy. And when you look at things right now, this was, well, probably 10 years ago we had this discussion. And now when you look at things, it's $20 and less is what most of the purchase prices are for things online. And here's that microeconomy. And now we've got the cryptocurrency that's creeping in to try to, and even the banks have gotten involved with that somehow because they see, okay, here's where things are going. And how effectively can we level the playing field so that we all have an equitable stake in our future?
We're at the foothills of that transition, and it's about to be given a real boost forward this week, particularly in the United States, because the Security and Exchange Commission there is likely to legitimize big firms like BlackRock and Fidelity and ARK Invest and others into being able to trade Bitcoin through an exchange traded fund. So this would be the first time a cryptocurrency is being acknowledged by the authorities in the States. It's already happened in Canada and other bits of the world, but
As much as the
as a
U.S.
new
has been
asset
leaders
class.
in some things, we've been far behind in others.
Yeah, but I was thinking the other day, then we've grown up in a time when we would normally our normal expectation would be that a dollar or a pound in my case, as time goes by, would buy you less and less. What you can spend $100 on now or £100 on now compared to 20 years ago, it's like chalk and cheese. It just doesn't go as far. Now imagine living in a world where you get paid in a currency where your expectation is the complete reverse of that. That technology advances will bring the price of goods down because of because we get more and more productive at producing it. Like you're going to have AIs producing products via code that they write. The cost of that production is going to be pretty small, right? So if you've got prices coming down and hard money that appreciates in value over time, not depreciates in value over time. The psychological impact of growing up, expecting things to get cheaper and your money to go further, is a mirror opposite of the world we grew up in.
Oh, yeah, it's a total to thinking about Andy now because she's pretty vocal about this. It's a total mind fuck.
Yes. It does take. It's taken me, I should say, I don't want to speak for everybody. It's taken me a lot of hours of thinking about what this new world could look like if we can freely connect, like we're doing now. We're having a transatlantic video call that's costing next to zero. We'll soon be able to transfer money anywhere in the world, exchange value anywhere in the world with no frictions in the way. So, and that money could be one that, we could reasonably expect to grow in value over time and help us be more wealthier than the expectation we have at the moment. Now, that psychologically, for people's well-being, it's got to be massive, huh?
Yes, it is. Now,
I
and
don't want to worship
my gosh,
money.
this is just, I am, there's so many places and tangents and things that we could go off on just this discussion alone. However, I've got to bring it to a close.
Yeah.
And in doing so, this is a great point to jump off with. What do you, or what kind of advice would you give to those wrestling with these things that you just mentioned and the transcendence or integration of it? What can you recommend how to proceed on a daily basis?
Well, I would say that as far as you're able to be curious about why the status quo needn't be all there is. So if life looks shitty, if life looks difficult, as it did for me for over 50 years, I'm not saying that all of that was bad. I'm not saying that at all, far from it. But I had some pretty big issues to deal with, which I didn't deal with very well. And I got to a point of thinking, well, there's no hope. There's no way out of this. And there is. So to just notice what your resistances are, to notice the automatic way we think that it'll never get any better, and simply to get a little curious about that. How right am I about that? What if I was wrong about that? What if there's something in that's wrong and that's right that we put together in a new way that makes things something new appear that you'd never thought about before? So it's that really, is to try and break free of the automaticity of the way we think about stuff that is problematic to us, and to use the curiosity that comes with that to see whether something new shows up.
Awesome. Roger, this has just been an amazing conversation, and what a way to end it with those suggestions. Those were superlative. Thank you.
Thank you, Zen. I've really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you for inviting me. It's much appreciated.
My pleasure, and see you on the bench soon.
See you on the bench soon.
Namaste and in law catch. And thank you for sticking with us for this episode of One World in a New World. I'm your host, Zen Benefiel, and I will see you next time.